I'm Jack Ledbetter. Teach English at California Lutheran College in Thousand Oaks. And I teach poetry, creative writing, and American Lit, children's lit, and sometimes criticism, and sometimes Russian novel, and things like that. And when I teach class in a novel, one of the books I use a lot is Elmer Gaine, Sinclair Lewis. So I thought it might be fun this summer to talk about him a little bit. I talked about Tolkien yesterday in The Lord of the Rings, and I like that a great deal. And another book I brought up here to talk about probably next week is Madame Bovary, Flaubert's great novel. So I thought we'd just settle back and I want to talk and just read to you. Might help to get some sense of how many already know this book, because I don't want to bore you to death. If you already really know it, then I might as well talk about Tolkien, because I'm bored. But yesterday, almost everybody knew Tolkien, because you can always count on that. How many were here yesterday? I just retell that story briefly about when I was teaching at the University of Nebraska, and I was talking about Lord of the Rings and the Hobbits and all that stuff. And I said something, and a fellow's hand went up in the back, and he said, "No, it happened to Aragorn in the year 2000 or whatever." And I said, "Oh, thanks." So I went over, and I said, "Then they crossed the Misty Mountains," and his hand went up. He said, "No, it wasn't the Misty Mountains. It was something Ford." I said, "Oh, thank you." And I went on for about 5 minutes, and every he'd raise his hand, he'd correct me. And I finally said, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" I said, how many times have you read this book?" He said, 18. I said, 18? Well, that's 17 and a half more than I read it. So I called him up to the front, and we sat on the front of the desk, and we team taught the freshman English class that semester. He was 18. I think it did him a world of good. It didn't hurt me. Because every time I wanted to know, I'd check with my friend here. I said, can I say this now? Is this accurate? This is not an epic, however. This is satire, and there's a big difference between dealing with an epic, even a folk epic, as Tolkien is, and this stuff. So how many of you have read this book? Long time ago, that counts. A long time ago, I read one of the most influential books in my life, Seven Story Mountain by Thomas Merton, a long time ago. And little did I know that 3 or 4 years ago, I'd pick it up again after a long interval and get so completely immersed in it that I would make Tolkien probably the rest of my life's work, and which included a visit, a retreat to the Gethsemane Abbey in Kentucky where Merton lived, and complete involvement in Zen and Catholicism and Mertoni and all that stuff, just from a book that I read a long time ago. You always do that. You read a book and you never know where that influence is going to leave off. It comes back sometimes. You like to think teachers do that to students. Who knows? Well, Sinclair Lewis, as you may know, was born in Sauk Center, Minnesota in 1885 and won the Pulitzer Prize for Aerosmith, which is a book about doctoring, and refused the Pulitzer Prize, interestingly enough, turned it down. I've forgotten why. But then he won the Nobel Prize, and he didn't turn that one down. Took that one. There's only been a handful of Americans who've won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think 9 people have won it, and he's one of them. Robert Frost should have won it, didn't, but this fellow did. As you probably know, a great satirist. Have you read Babbitt? Remember good old Babbitt, the gung-ho booster club, wears the go big red button, attended all the right meetings, has a real estate office in Zenith, little town, mythical town in Ohio. Liked to go to all the church socials and be upstanding community person, and it would take anybody he could in real estate deals, and his conscience never bothered him, and just an all-around good fellow. So every time Sinclair Lewis wrote about somebody, you could feel sure you're going to get roasted. Some of you are from Minnesota, no doubt, and you probably know that he was really roasted in his hometown, God, so he couldn't go back home. They weren't sure they wanted this person around anymore. And this time he's roasting the clergy. I won't ask if we have clergy here, best I don't know right now. But he really roasts them. Elmer Gantry is a Baptist preacher, and then he goes on to be a Methodist preacher. And he goes on to be one of the most successful preachers in the history of preacherdom in the Midwest. And he's an absolute fraud and a fake inside out. But one thing he can do is preach. And he has a great mellifluous baritone voice. And when he was a seminary student at Terwilliger College in Gritsmacher Springs, Kansas, he memorized a bunch of phrases that sounded good. one particular little prayer, and he had no idea what it meant, but every time he got in a bad way, he would always whip out this prayer, and he said it so forcefully that people said, "My goodness, what a, must be a man of God." And he'd say, "I am sister," or so-and-so, or brother, or so-and-so. Then he would whip out names, words that the little farmers down in Grismacher Springs, Kansas, weren't sure about, like baptizo, and Athanasian, and adiaphora, and things like that. They'd just swoon when he said things like that. So he got through. The book opens with a very simple phrase. My book's falling apart as I go. It says, "Elmer Gantry was drunk." That's the opening line. That's almost as good an opening line as Melville's "Call Me Ishmael." I think that's better, but this will do. He was always drunk as a student. And obviously, if you're in Terwilliger College in Grismacher Springs, Theological College or Bible College in Kansas, you're not supposed to be drunk. You're not even supposed to be drinking. But he was, so I just want to let you know how this opened. Now, let me just read some passages for you. And if you have questions or comments, stop me at any time, will you? This book is built around his escapades, affairs of the heart, whatever you want to call them, with three women. Some of you may have seen the movie. Did anybody see the movie? I said that with such assurance, like, yeah. It was a good movie. As movies go, you know, they usually ruin books. This is one they didn't do such a bad job. Burt Lancaster won an Academy Award for playing Elmer Gantry. And the whole movie centered around his association with Sharon Falconer, who was loosely based on Amy Semple McPherson, lady evangelist in Los Angeles and so forth. But the book is based around three women, and we'll get to those. Okay. Here's an opening description of Elmer Gantry in college. Elmer Gantry, best known to classmates as Hellcat, had this autumn of 1902 been football captain and led the best team Terwilliger College had ever known in 10 years. They had won the championship of the East Middle Kansas Conference, which consisted of 10 denominational colleges, all of them with buildings and presidents and chapel services and yells and colors and a standard of scholarship equal to the best high schools. But since the last night of the football season, with the glorious bonfire in which the young gentleman had burned up 9 tar barrels, the sign of the Jew tailor, and the president's tabby cat, Elmer had been tortured by boredom. That's our introduction to Elmer Gantry. Now you can see, I don't have to belabor the point of satire. It's just really plain. He does it with a mace. There are some satirists, of course, who are very subtle at satire. And then there's Sinclair Lewis. And when he says they have the best scholarship equal to the best high schools, well, that's not saying a whole lot for your scholarship in your college if it's equal to the best high schools. It's one of the deadliest things that a prof can hear, I think, is when a person says, one of your freshmen, apparently, particularly, says, "Gee, I had this stuff in high school." It just makes you wince. Well, you're getting it again, kid. You probably didn't learn it the first time. And probably won't learn it this time either. Terwilliger College, founded and preserved by the more zealous Baptists. Any Baptists in here? My background, my relatives are all hard-shell Baptists, they call themselves, in Southern Illinois. So when I read this stuff, I see all my relatives sitting here. They would never. My Aunt Emma would never read this book. She'd burn it. Terwilliger College, founded and preserved by the more zealous Baptists, is on the outskirts of Grismacher Springs, Kansas. The springs have dried up, and the Grismachers have gone to Los Angeles to sell bungalows and delicatessen. It huddles on the prairie, which is storm-racked in winter, frying and dusty in summer, lovely only in the grass-rustling spring or drowsy autumn. You would not be likely to mistake Terwilliger College for an old folks' home, because on the campus is a large rock painted with class numerals. Most of the faculty are ex-ministers. So there's the introduction to the college. You gotta like this book. I think it's hilarious. I have talked to people about it who have been outraged when they find out what a rat this guy is, and they get very put out, and they say, "Ministers aren't like this," and on and on and on. Well, I'm not saying they are, but I still think it's a very funny book. Satire can be very funny if you kind of go with it. Maybe Swift would be an exception. There's very little funny about Swift. It's funny in an off-centered way, maybe. Okay, there it is. Now I just want to kind of skip around and read you some bits and pieces of things. He's in college now in his sophomore, junior year, whatever, and they're having a big annual time, kind of a fair-like thing going on the campus, and they're bringing in one of their graduates. Judd Roberts, good graduate of Terwilliger, he's made it big, and he's coming back to talk to the boys in the college, saying, if I did it, you can do it, and so forth. Between prayer meetings at Terwilliger, Judson Roberts sat in the Bible History Seminar Room at a long table under a bilious map of the Holy Land and had private conferences with the men students. A surprising number of them came edging in, trembling with averted eyes, to ask advice about a secret practice, and old Judd seemed amazingly able to guess their trouble before they got going. Well now, old boy, I'll tell you, terrible thing, all right, but I've met quite a few cases, and you just want to buck up and take it to the Lord in prayer. Remember that he is able to help unto the uttermost. Now the first thing you want to do is get rid of, I'm afraid you have some pretty nasty pictures and maybe a juicy book hidden away. Now haven't you, old boy? How could old Judd have guessed? What a corker. That's right, I've got a swell plan, old boy. Make a study of missions. And think how clean and pure and manly you'd want to be if you were going to carry the joys of Christianity to a lot of poor gazebos that are under the evil spell of Buddhism and a lot of these heathen religions. Wouldn't you want to be able to look them in the eye and shame them? Next thing to do is get a lot of exercise. Get out and run like hell and take cold baths, darn cold. There now, rising with ever so manly a handshake. Now skip along and remember, with a tremendous and fetching and virile laugh, just run like hell. That's Judson Roberts. So the boys would go back and think they can get through another year at Terwilliger College in Bitsmacher Springs, Kansas. Now Elmer is, by any yardstick, a terrible student. He's C minus at best in his classes. The professors have no hope for him. They know he's not going to make it. They hope he's not going to make it, because then they'd have to ordain him and say he's one of ours, and they know that'd be a terrible thing. And so they're not too worried about it. They sort of ignore him, thinking, well, he'll eventually either fail or quit or take up farming or something. We won't have to worry about it. So they're not looking at him too closely. Comes time at the end of the year when somebody has to give the sort of the valedictorian speech, or not the valedictory speech, but a sort of a hellfire and brimstone speech. And who should show up to do it but Elmer Gantry? And now everybody in the auditorium is spellbound. I said, who let this man in? Not Elmer. What about little Eddie Fisslinger, who knows 190,000 Bible passages and won all kinds of little pins for it? Or what about so-and-so? But not Elmer Gantry. He stands up there in his big, brawny guy in his big black suit. And he has picked up a book the night before, probably the first book he's opened, by Robert Ingersoll, a noted Bible critic. And in this, he opened it at random, and here's this prayer. Love is the only bow on life's dark cloud. Bow. It is the morning and the evening star. It shines upon the cradle of the babe and sheds its radiance upon the quiet tomb. It is the mother of art, inspirer of poet, patriot, and philosopher. And it goes on. Now, he's memorized this, so he stands up there and he starts emoting this stuff. And the people in the front row look up and say, is this Elmer? Is this our Elmer who's talking about the morning and evening star? Inspire a poet. It is the air and light of every heart, builder of every home, kindler of every fire and every hearth. It was the first to dream of immortality. It fills the world with melody, for music is the voice of love. Love is the magician, the enchanter, that changes worthless things to joy and makes right royal kings and queens of common clay. It is the perfume of the wondrous flower, the heart. And without that sacred passion, that divine swoon, we are less than beasts. But with it, earth is heaven and we are gods. And you can just sort of see the congregation sitting there, all these old profs and the theologians saying, where did he get that stuff? And of course, everybody else thinks it's great, all the people who have come from miles around. I think it's wonderful. So he seems to be progressing in the seminary, in the college, and it comes a time when they're going to have to do something with him, because he's getting close to the point where they're going to have to ordain this guy. And so they pretty much have to do that. They have a big ceremony down by the river where all the new candidates are given their charge and giving their first calls to the various congregations around. And there's Elmer. And Sinclair Lewis has an interesting passage on this day when they charge the candidates. The questions were followed by a charge to the candidates, a tremendous discourse by the great Dr. Engle, in which he commended study, light meals, and helping the sick by going and reading texts to them. Everyone joined in a tremendous basket lunch on long plank tables by the cool river. Banana layer cake, donuts, fried chicken, chocolate layer cake, scallop potatoes, hermit cookies, coconut layer cake, pickled tomato preserves on plates which skidded about the table. with coffee poured into saucerless cups from a vast tin pot, inevitably scalding at least one child who howled. There were hearty shouts of, "Pass the lemon pie, Sister Skiff," and that was a fine discourse of Brother Ingalls, and, "Oh dear, I dropped my spoon and an ant's got on it. Well, I'll just wipe it on my apron." That was fine, the way Brother Gantry explained how the Baptist Church has existed ever since Bible days. Boys bathing, shrieking, splashing one another, boys getting into the poison ivy, boys becoming so infected with the poison ivy they would turn spotty and begin to swell within 7 hours. Dr. Ingle enthusiastically and telling the other clergy of his trip to the Holy Land. Elmer lying about his fondness for the faculty of this theological seminary. So you can see the kind of day it is. It's probably hot like this and maybe as many flies as we have here. All. They are pesky today, aren't they? So Sinclair Lewis does a couple of things. He swats these guys. He hits them pretty hard in his satire. But then he has enough love for the Midwest, enough love for the church, I think, in his way, to set a kind of a nice tone. It's very nice to think of all these young guys getting their first commission, and they're having the picnic, and you got your pot luck supper out there, and the kids falling in the poison ivy. It's very Americana. And he sets you up with that kind of a tone. He turns right around and pulls the rug out and makes somebody like Gantry the hero of all this. So it's a paradox he's working with there. Would anybody like me to shut the doors? I mean, it's hot, but we at least keep the flies out. What's your pleasure? Does it matter? Die from heat or flies? What a choice.
Here we are, pray.
Yeah, we need Elmer Gantry.
Yeah.
Elmer knows he's got one thing going for him, that's his voice. So he works on that. Here's an interesting short paragraph. It says, "Elmer's eloquence increased like an August pumpkin. He went into the woods to practice. Once a small boy came behind him, standing on a stump in a clearing, and upon being greeted with, 'I denounce the abominations of your lascivious and voluptuous, oh, abominations,' the boy fled yelping and never was again the same carefree youth."
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. pardon me, throat's going too.
Why did...
I gotta close these.
Lewis do this kind of thing?
Why?
Did he write to make money, you know, to win prizes, or did he have an axe to grind, or?
Well, it's probably some of that, yeah. Why does anybody write satire without getting into a long discourse on it? A lot of people think that the satirists are probably the biggest idealists, the greatest idealists, someone who cares so much that when he or she sees the world or an institution that is not, some doesn't seem to match up to that ideal they have, it just drives them crazy, and they have a great deal of difficulty dealing with that in a positive way, so they turn to satire. It's easy to put a satirist in the camp of a sour mouth, malcontent, and maybe they are some of the time, but very often there are people who care a great deal, but in getting at that, they turn to satire in order to make the point. They overemphasize in order to make their point.
Did he write satire before he became popular, or after?
Good question. I don't know. Don't have a good answer for that. I suspect, I've read, all of, or most of Sinclair Lewis, everything has this blade in it, pretty much. I think Babbitt and this are the probably the heaviest satire, but everything's got a knife edge to it. Yeah. If there's other reasons why he wrote this way, I don't have that one.
Why did you choose Sinclair Lewis then for religious satire and not more contemporarily Peter DeVries?
I like Sinclair Lewis.
Do you think Sinclair Lewis is a better writer?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, I like him, yeah. Somebody asked me that the other day. Harry asked me that. I was doing a thing on favorite poets the other day. He said, "Why are they your favorite poets?" And the only answer you can come up with is because I like them. The ones you, Robert Frost.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
And all literature.
Sure. If I was going to do a class on satire, I'd include, you know, a number of people that do satire really well. I just happen to like this book. That's all. No very philosophic reason, I think.
It's just
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, I just like him. Okay, so our boy is moving towards getting out of the school, and they're going to have to do something with him. So they send him down to a little town called Schoenheim, Kansas. And,
what was the name?
S-C-H-O-E-H-E-I-M. Schoenheim, I assume. Is that where you're from?
No.
Hope there's no such place. This better be fictional. He makes a great case that everything is purely coincidental, which didn't stop people from wanting to tar and feather him anyway. Thomas Wolfe said the same thing, Look Homeward Angel. There's nothing about Asheville, North Carolina in my book. And when he went back home, he was not welcome anymore. All writers do that, and it's true when they say this person doesn't really exist, but it's also true that they got it from a person who does exist. It may be a composite, but it never comes completely out of the imagination. You've got to know people to see these people, sure. Okay, down we go to Kansas. He goes to Kansas and he meets Lulu. Lulu Baines is the first gal he meets, in first person that he's involved with. Lulu Baines is teaching Sunday school down there, and Elmer walks in. The first thing he wants to do is smoke a cigar, which Baptist preachers aren't supposed to do. And he says thinks he's going to be bored with this call. It's going to be a terrible place. And he looks over, and there's this delightful young girl teaching Sunday school, and it's Lulu Baines. And he immediately says, "Ah, I must have her." That's his opening line. So he puts out a cigar, puffs up this great manly black broadcloth suited chest, and walks over and says things like Baptizo and Athanasian and all these things, and just sweeps the poor girl off her feet and pats the little boys in the Sunday school class and generally becomes a hero. He says, "You can call me Elmer." And immediately the people, Lulu's father takes him in and he stays with them. It's like inviting the dog into the meat locker. And before long, he and Lulu are, there's a great passage in here, what I won't take the time to find right now, where they're sitting up very late, and finally Lulu's father says, "Well, I guess I'll get up and go to bed." And he walks upstairs, and immediately Lulu and Elmer are on each other's arms, and a passionate scene ensues, which Sinclair Lewis does not describe. And then after that, Lulu is straightening her clothes and sort of doing her hair, and he says Elmer didn't have much heat left in him now. And then Lulu turns to him with a little kittenish grin and says, "When will we be married?" I just killed a fly on your face. I don't know what that means. Slow-witted things, aren't they? They're persistent, but dull. And she said, when will we be married?" And there was this great sinking in Elmer's stomach. And he was looking forward to going back for his final year at the seminary after that. And he didn't have that in mind. But he can't get away from her. And she's determined that this is going to be a marriage. So she had gone previously with her cousin, Floyd. And Elmer finds that and realizes here's a chance to get out of this thing. Another thing that brought him back to this little church, though, because there was a knock on his seminary dorm room door one day, and there's Lulu's father with a shotgun saying, I figured it was just an oversight on your part, Reverend, but I'm sure you're coming back to marry my little girl, aren't you? With his 12-gauge across his arm. And so Elmer figures Baptizo and Athanasian is not going to do it this time. He says, "Lead the way." And back he comes, but with an idea. He says, "I've got to get out of this." And Elmer just lands on his feet every time in these situations. So he tries to set up something with Elmer and Lulu, and he gets them together. And he figures if he can just get them together, old Floyd, who loves Lulu still, is going to take over. So they embrace. Okay. Elmer fled to the barnyard, found Deacon Baines, that's Lulu's father, and demanded harshly, "Come here. I want you to see what Floyd and Lulu are doing. Put that lantern down. I've got one of these electric dinguses here." He had bought it for this purpose. He also had a revolver in his pocket. When Elmer and the bewildered Mr. Baines burst upon them, saw them in the circle from the electric flashlight, Lulu and Floyd were deep in a devastating kiss. "There," bellowed the outraged Elmer, "now you see why I hesitated to be engaged to that woman. I've suspected it all along. Oh, abomination, abomination. And she that committeth it shall be cut off." Floyd sprang up a fighting hound. Elmer could doubtless have handled him, but it was Deacon Baines who, with one maniac blow, knocked Floyd down. The deacon turned to Elmer then, with the first tears he had known since boyhood. "Forgive me and mine, brother. we have sinned against you. This woman shall suffer for it always. She'll never enter my house again. She'll, by God, marry Floyd. And he's the shiftlessest damn fool farmer in 10 counties. I'm going. I can't stand this. I'll send you another preacher. I'll never see any of you again, said Elmer. I don't blame you. Try to forgive us, brother. The deacon was sobbing now, dusty, painful sobbing, bewildered sobs of anger. The last thing Elmer saw in the light of his electric torch was Lulu huddled with shrunk shoulders, her face insane with fear. And that's how the first section of the book is left. Always with a woman, always smashed now, and our boy Elmer straightening that great broadcloth suit and saying the evening and the morning star speech again, and he goes off. But he doesn't fare very well when he gets back, because some words have gotten back to the seminary, and he makes the mistake and goes out and ties one on, gets really drunk one night, and he has a message to come in and see the dean one day. And I got one of those messages myself, not for that reason, but for because I used to teach at Concordia College in Seward, Nebraska, and I did a chapel talk one day, and this is by way of digression. The office mate was a nice guy, so I said, George, let's do Jesus Christ in Plum Creek Woods, because Plum Creek and the Blue River ran behind the college. So George, who was always in game for things, said, fine. So he put on a robe, he had a nice beard, and put sandals on. It was November, and it was cold. And he went down to Plum Creek, and I took my camera, and I snapped pictures of him jumping over logs and sliding around on the ice and pounding a hole in the ice and drinking cold water, and the farmer's dog came down and they wrestled. I had super pictures, and I thought they were super. And I had 36 of those buggers, and I got the Moldau on tape, and I had a student in the doing it, and it was the whole package. And the students loved it. And I got a note in my box the next day from the dean of the chapel. He says, come and see me. And I thought, about time to get a little recognition around this place. I walked in there, and he had that Marine Corps set grin on his face, which he always had when he dismissed students. Says, you know, we're kicking you out. He says, come in, Jack, sit down. I go, oh, good. He says, about your chapel. And I said, yes. He says, the secretaries didn't understand it. I said, oh, well, I didn't write it for the secretaries, but I'm sorry they didn't understand it. He says, and besides, it's slightly pantheistic. Pantheistic. And then he floored me with the next comment. He says, and where was the gospel message? I said, gospel message? I have 36 slides of Jesus Christ on Plum Creek, and you ask where's the gospel? He said, why don't you rewrite it and do it again? I didn't do it. But it was interesting when I got that. Every time I hear of a note from the dean, I think of it.
So is that why you're at California?
Probably. No, Seward was a nice place, beautiful little town. I just was aching to go back to California, I think, at the time. Actually, I'm from a farm in southern Illinois, so I'm more Midwest than coast, but I've been there too long, I suppose, to escape now. Okay, so Elmer is out of a job. He's been kicked out of the seminary, and he doesn't know quite what to do now. So he's got to do something. And he runs into Sharon Falconer. He just stumbles into this tent meeting going on, this revival down by the river. And he's bored, and he's sitting there, and he wonders who the preacher is. And then there was a pause in the noise in the tent. Everyone waited, a little uneasy. Their eyes went to the top platform. Elmer gasped. Coming from some refuge behind the platform, coming slowly, her beautiful arms outstretched to them, appeared a saint. She was young, Sharon Falconer. Surely not 30, stately, slender, and tall. And in her long, slim face, her black eyes, her splendor of black hair, was rapture or boiling passion. The sleeves of her straight white robe with its ruby girdle were slashed and fell away from her arms as she drew everyone to her. God, prayed Elmer Gantry. And that instant, his planless life took on plan and resolute purpose. He was going to have Sharon Falconer. So he's off and running. It's like Toad in Wind in the Willows. Every time Toad saw some new thing, it was whether it was the motor car or boats, that was his passion. So Elmer insinuates himself into the troupe. Sharon Falconer has 8 or 9 people, a piano player, somebody beats the drum, an advanced man who goes out and rounds up the clergy. And so Elmer just sort of muscles in and insinuates himself into the troupe and eventually becomes her right-hand person. And he's terribly in love with Sharon Falconer. She's very saint-like and very mysterious, and he just doesn't know, he never met a woman like this. So she knows he's in love with her, and she invites him during a lull in their going from city to city. She invites him to her ranch. It was a farm somewhere, I think it's in Virginia somewhere. And he thinks, now's the time, this is it. So they're just having dinner, and they just relax after dinner. And he looks over at her and says something about, your hair is so beautiful, and tries to put his arm around her. And at that time, she suddenly, clutching his arm, she cried, come, it is the call. He was bewildered as he followed her, white in her nightgown, trimmed at the throat with white fur, out of the room, down the hall, up a steep little stairway to her own apartments. The more bewildered to go from that genteel corridor with its forget-me-not wallpaper and stiff engravings of Virginia Worthy's into a furnace of scarlet. Her bedroom was as insane as an oriental cozy corner of 1895, a couch high on carbon ivory posts, covered with a mandarin coat, unlighted brass lamps in the likeness of mosques and pagodas, gilt papier-mâché armor on the walls, a wide dressing table with a score of cosmetics and odd Parisian bottles, tall candlesticks, the twisted and flowered candles lighted, and over everything a hint of incense. She opened a closet, tossed a robe to him, and cried for the service of the altar, and vanished into a dressing room beyond. Diffidently, feeling rather like a fool, he put on the robe. It was a purple velvet embroidered with black symbols unknown to him, the collar heavy with gold thread. He was not quite sure what he was to do, and he waited obediently. She stood in the doorway posing while he gaped. She was so tall, and her hands at her sides, the backs up, the fingers arched, moved like lilies on the bosom of a stream. She was fantastic in a robe of deep crimson, adorned with golden stars and crescents, swastikas and towel crosses. Her feet were in silver sandals, and round her hair was a tiara of silver moons set with steel points that flickered in the candlelight. A mist of incense floated about her, seemed to rise from her, and as she slowly raised her arms, he felt in schoolboyish awe that she was veritably a priestess. Her voice was under the spell of the sleepwalker once more as she sighed, come, it is the chapel. She marched to a door part hidden by the couch and led him into a room. Now he was no longer part amorous, part inquisitive, but all uneasy. What hanky-panky of construction had been performed, he never knew. Perhaps it was merely that the floor above the small room had been removed, so that it stretched up two stories. But in any case, there it was, a shrine bright as bedlam at the bottom, but seeming to rise through darkness to the sky. The walls were hung with black velvet, there were no chairs, and the whole room focused on a wide altar. It was an altar of grotesque humor, or of madness, draped with Chinese fabrics, crimson, apricot, emerald, gold. There were two stages of pink marble. Above the altar hung an immense crucifix, with the Christ bleeding at nail wounds and pierced side, and on the upper stage were plaster busts of the Virgin St. Teresa, St. Catherine, a garish Sacred Heart, a Dolores Simulcrum of the dying St. Stephen. But crowded in the lower stage was a crazy rout of what Elmer called heathen idols, ape-headed gods, crocodile-headed gods, a god with three heads and a god with six arms, a jade and ivory Buddha, an alabaster naked Venus, and at the center of them all, a beautiful, hideous, intimidating, and alluring statuette of a silver goddess with a triple crown and a face as thin and long and passionate as that of Sharon Falconer. So now Elmer is really over his head. He doesn't know how he got into this, who this woman who suddenly thought this great Midwestern home-body preacher has turned into something else. It is the hour, she says. Blessed Virgin, Mother Hera, Mother Frigga, Mother Ishtar, Mother Isis, dread Mother Astarte of the weaving arms, it is thy priestess. It is she who alters the body. And she goes on and on this long litany. O rosy cross and mystic tower of ivory, hear my prayer. O sublime April crescent, hear my prayer. O sword of undaunted steel, most excellent. And on and on and on and on. And then she picks up the Bible and she reads some of that. And Elmer is standing there, his acolyte robe on, and not knowing what to do. He's starting to read some of this stuff. As he read on, his voice rose like a triumphant priest. I said, I will go up to the palm tree. I will take hold of the boughs thereof. That verse never finished, for she swayed sideways as she knelt before the altar and sank into his arms, her lips parted. So that is the sort of the consummation of this second part of the book, where he and Sharon Falconer are together from then on. But it's never quite the same, because he knows this woman is really a lot weirder than he had bargained for. So all along his way, he's learning a few things about life and about people. Okay, they go on to various small towns, and they hold meetings, and sometimes people show up, and sometimes people don't show up. In Scranton, they had unusually exasperating patience. Scranton had been saved by a number of other evangelists before their arrival, and they had become almost anesthetic. 10 nights they sweated over the audience without a single sinner coming forward, and Elmer had to go out and hire half a dozen convincing converts. He found them in a mission near the river and explained that by giving a good example to the slothful, they would be doing the work of God, and that if the example was good enough, he would give them $5 apiece. The missioner himself came in during the conference and offered to get converted for 10, but he was so well known that Elmer had to give him 10 to stay away. His gang of converts was very impressive, but thereafter no member of the evangelistic troop was safe. The professional Christians besieged the tent night and day. They wanted to be saved again. When they were refused, they offered to produce new converts, $5 apiece, $3 apiece, 50 cents and a square meal. But this time enough authentic and free enthusiasts were appearing, and though they were fervent, they did not relish being saved in company with hobos who smelled. When the half dozen cappers were thrown out bodily by Elmer, they took to coming to the meetings and catcalling, so that for the rest of the series they had to be paid $1 a night each to stay away. So they finally reached New Jersey. They worked their way through Midwest, through the East. And it's been Sharon Faulkner's dream all this time to have her own setup. She has finally enough money, so they buy a pier at New Jersey. And on the end of this pier is a big round building. And that's her tabernacle, finally. This is their home base. And they're getting ready for their opening crusade. And they've got it all decorated, freshly painted, streamers and banners, and Elmer's all ready with his Evening Star and his speech. The only speech he ever learned, of course, the whole book is that one. And he's got that code. And they're getting ready, and the throng, the thing is full. Her reputation has multiplied, and so we pick it up at that point where they're backstage, as it were, getting ready. And the congregation's being worked on by a couple of people singing hymns. And there's the workmen in the back of the pier have just finished painting the last thing, and they're out there having a last cigarette before they leave. The workmen moved away dark figures between the sea and the doors that gave on the bright auditorium. The discarded cigarette nestled against the oily rags which the workmen had dropped on the promenade beside the flimsy walls of the tabernacle. A rag glowed round the edges, worm-like, then lit in circling flame. Sharon was chanting, "What could be more beautiful than a tabernacle like this, set on the bosom of the rolling deep? Oh, think what the mighty tides have meant in holy writ, the face of the waters on which moved the Spirit of Almighty God, when the earth was but a whirling and a chaotic darkness. Jesus baptized in the sweet waters of Jordan, Jesus walking in the waves. So could we today if we had but his faith. Oh, dear God, strengthen thou our unbelief, give us faith like unto thine own." Elmer, sitting back listening, was moved, as in his first adoration for her. He had become so tired of her poeticizing that he almost admitted to himself that he was tired. But tonight he felt her strangeness again, and in it he was humble. He saw her straight back, shimmering in white satin. He saw her superb arms as she stretched them out to these thousands. And in the hot secret pride, he gloated that this beauty, beheld and worshipped by so many, belonged to him alone. Then he noted something else. A third of the way back, coming through one of the doors opening on the promenade, was a curl of smoke. He startled. He almost rose. He feared to rouse a panic and sat with his brain a welter of terrified jelly till he heard the scream, "Fire! Fire!" and saw the whole audience and the choir leaping up, screaming, 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 while the flimsy door jamb was alight and the flame rose fan-like toward the rafters. Only Sharon was in his mind. Sharon standing like an ivory column against the terror. He rushed toward her. He could hear her wailing, "Don't be afraid. Go out slowly." She turned toward the choir as with wild white robes they charged down from their bank of seats. She clamored, "Don't be afraid, we're in the temple of the Lord. He won't harm you. I believe. Have faith. I'll lead you safely through the flames." But they ignored her, streamed past her, thrusting her aside. He seized her arm. "Come here, Shara, the door at the back. We'll jump over and swim ashore." She seemed not to hear him. She thrust his hand away and went on demanding, her voice furious with mad sincerity, "Who will trust the Lord God of hosts? Now we'll try our faith. Who will follow me? Since 2/3 of the auditorium was to the shoreward side of the fire, and since the wide doors to the promenade were many, most of the audience were getting safely out, save for a child crushed, a woman fainting and trampled. But toward the stage, the flames driven by the sea wind were beating up through the rafters. Most of the choir and the audience down front had escaped, but all who were now at the back were cut off. He grasped Sharon's arm again, and in a voice abject with fear, he shouted, "For God's sake, beat it! We can't wait!" She had an insane strength. She thrust him away so sharply that he fell against a chair, bruising his knee. Furious with pain, senseless with fear, he raged, "You can go to hell," and galloped off, pushing aside the last of the hysterical choir. He looked back and saw her quite alone, holding up the white wooden cross which had stood by the pulpit, marching steadily forward, a tall figure pale against the screen of flames. All of the choir who had not got away remembered or guessed the small door at the back. The door opened inward, only it did not open, with a score of victims thrust against it. In howling panic, Elmer sprang among them, knocked them aside, struck down a girl who stood in his way, yanked open the door, and got through it, the last, the only one to get through it. He never remembered leaping, but he found himself in the surf, desperately swimming toward shore, horribly cold, horribly bound by heavy clothes. He humped out of his coat. In the inside pocket was Lily Anderson's address. The sea by night, though it was glaring now with flames from above, seemed infinite in its black sightlessness. The waves thrust him among the piles. Their mossy slime was like the feel of serpents to his frantic hands, and the barnacles cut his palms. But he struggled out from beneath the pier, struggled toward shore, and as he swam and panted, more and more was the sea blood red about him. In blood he swam, blood that was icy cold and tumultuous and roaring in his knees. His knees struck sand, and he crawled ashore among a shrieking, torn, sea-soaked crowd. Many had leaped from the rail of the promenade and were still fighting the surf, wailing and beaten. Their wet and corpse-like heads were seen clearly in the glare. The pier was only a skeleton, a cage round a boiling of flame, with dots of figures still dropping from the promenade. Elmer ran out a little into the surf and dragged in a woman who had already safely touched bottom. He had rescued at least 30 people who had already rescued themselves before the reporters got to him, and he had to stop and explain the cause of the fire, the cost of the tabernacle, the amount of the insurance, the size of the audience, the number of souls revived by Miss Falconer during all her campaigns, and the fact that he had been saving both Miss Falconer and himself when they had been crushed by a falling rafter. 111 people died that night, including all of the gospel crew, save Elmer. It was Elmer himself who at dawn found Sharon's body lying in a floor beam. There were rags of white satin clinging to it, and her charred hand was still the charred cross. So that ends the second part, again with a woman, again with tragedy for the woman, and Elmer somehow coming through it all. If you can imagine the scene of him coming ashore in the surf, and sort of in Elmer Gantry style, picking up people who were already saved, who didn't need it, and then stopping and to describe the reporter, the insurance, the number of people, the cost of the tabernacle. I mean, it sounds deadly, but it's absolutely true to life, isn't it? I mean, there's always somebody around, a reporter in the midst of a tragedy, shoving a microphone in your mouth saying, "How do you feel now that your children have just been crushed by a 10, you know, whatever?" And Elmer, of course, being that insensitive oaf he is, takes the time to stop. Whereas I think most people, any decency would probably say, "Go answer your own questions," or "Don't bother me, leave me in my grief." But not Elmer. He has all the figures, and he's ready. And of course, I was trying to save poor Sharon at the time, poor thing, and on and on. Okay. The last section deals with Elmer changing from the Baptist to the Methodist. For some reason, he thinks maybe he's going to have a better time there. The Baptists have just about had it. And he finds the Methodists more receptive to him. But meanwhile, he doesn't have a church to go to yet. He runs into another lady. Her name is Mrs. Evans Riddle. Mrs. Evans Riddle has a neat thing going, which Sinclair Lewis really hammers. She was the proprietor of the Victory Thought Power headquarters in New York. And not even in Los Angeles was there a more important center of a pre-digested philosophy and pansy-painted ethics. She maintained a magazine filled with such starry thoughts as, "All the world's a robe whereon we are but fellow wayfarers." She held morning and vesper services on Sunday at Euterpean Hall on 87th Street, and between moments of silent thought, she boxed with the inexplicable. She taught, or farmed out, classes in concentration, prosperity, love, metaphysics, oriental mysticism, and the fourth dimension. She instructed small select circles how to keep one's husband, how to understand Sanskrit philosophy without understanding either Sanskrit or philosophy, how to become slim without giving up pastry. She healed all the diseases in the medical dictionary and some which were not. And in personal consultations at $10 the half hour, she explained to unappetizing elderly ladies how they might rouse passion in a football hero. She had a staff, including a real Hindu Swami. Anyway, he was a real Hindu, but she was looking for a first assistant. And guess who she finds? Our boy, Elmer. Now, Elmer takes one look at this setup and sees the light. He realizes that PR and advertising is the way to success. So immediately he sets up his own little operation. He takes out ads in the papers. The world owes you $1 million. Why don't you collect it? Have you ever seen ads like this? In case you haven't, I've got a whole bunch of them. I picked it from various places, though I don't know where I got. Here's one that says, free bonus when you order. I don't know what you're supposed to, what, oh. Yes, I want government cash right away is what you're supposed to order. And for your free bonus, how you can make other people do exactly what you want them to do. Haven't you often wished that you possessed that rare power to command obedience from others in just a casual word, a brief glance? Haven't you? And on and on and on. Well, it's all over the place. Not too long ago, there's a place in Redondo Beach, California, and Redondo Beach has no market on wackos, but this woman was charging $25 a head for a money seminar, how you can unleash that power we all have within you to bring make money come to you. And I saw this, and she would stand up on a stage and tell everybody to take out their money, their bills, most of which, of course, went to her. Take out your ones and your fives and your tens, and they took them out. She's now, rub yourselves all over with them, and jog, and sing, and rub with money, and unleash this mystical power. And I could not believe my eyes that there were 30 or 40 adults in there who had paid $25 and they're rubbing themselves and singing and jumping, having a great time. Well, I don't know how much mystical power might have been unleashed, but here's Elmer trying it. Elmer says in his ad, what brought millions to Rockefeller, Morgan, Carnegie? Willpower. It's within you. Learn to develop it. You can. The world mastering secrets of the Rosicrucians. What does he know about the Rosicrucians? Nothing. And the Hindu sages revealed in 12 lessons by the renowned psychologist, Elmer Gantry, PhD, DD, PSD. I'm not quite sure about that. Write or phone for free personal consultation. I mean, all this he's going to give in 12 easy lessons, so he learns pretty fast. And he has a number of phrases, all stolen, and he made his disciples repeat them in chorus in the manner of all religions. Among the more powerful incantations were, I can be whatever I will to be. I turn my opened eyes on myself and possess whatever I desire. I am God's child. God created all good things, including wealth, and I will to inherit it. I am resolute. I am utterly resolute. I fear no man, whether in offices or elsewhere. Power is in me, encompassing you to my demands. Hold fast, O subconscious, the thoughts of prosperity. In the divine book of achievements, my name is written in gold. I am thus of the world's nobility, and now this moment I take possession of my kingdom. I am part of universal mind, and thus I summon to me my rightful universal power. Daily my subconscious shall tell me to not be content and go on working for somebody else. Those are the things these people chanted for $12 a lesson, and Elmer is making lots of money. So, he does all right in the Methodist Church. I'm going to skip towards the end here. In fact, he does so well that he gets one of the largest churches in the community, and he does all kinds of things. He'll bring in bands, and they'll sing songs like Dixie, and all kinds of things. And the people around, the other clergy, say, why is he having people sing Dixie? And it's a long way to Tipperary, and all those, and that's not the religious songs, but people loved it, and they crowded in. And his Sunday evenings, he would have the accordionists come in. He had one little three-year-old girl sit up on the altar and sing a song, The Good Ship Lollipop. People loved it. Never mind it. He would have object lessons. He brought in a terrible wrecked car from the highway out on the interstate, and he reassembled that thing on the chancel steps and did an object sermon on drunken driving. By people watch this terrible thing. He had a sing-off between the barbershop quartet from the casket factory and some of the boys down by the railroad, and he would hand over each one, ask the congregation to vote on which is the best. He would have the sinners sing against the saints against the married people against the single, men against women, all kinds of stuff. And some other preachers would finally come down sort of dressed in a top coat with their hat pulled down to see, what's this guy doing? He's got 2,500 people in his congregation already, and they're sure he's a charlatan, but they can't prove it. Well, guess who comes back to town? While he's just at the height of success, Lulu. Lulu and Floyd show up in this town. And Elmer, who has taken all kinds of vows of sort of celibacy, takes one look at Lulu and says, oh, you sweet kitten. And they start all over again. And so at the end of this book, and by the way, Elmer gets an honorary degree. A dean from the president of the college comes to Elmer, who now has the biggest church around, and says, gee, it'd be nice if you could support our college with, you know, $5,000 or $10,000. Elmer says, you know, I always wanted a degree. And they say, we understand each other, Brother Gantry. We understand each other. So he took $10,000 right off the top from the congregation, gave it to the church, and now he's Dr. Gantry. All right, to close, to let you know what's happening to our boy, he has been blackmailed. Some workers showed up in town, and this woman and a man, and she put the moves on Elmer, thinking this is a pigeon, and he was. And they're going to blackmail him now because it's all out. The Elmer has been caught in this assignation with this woman, and his career is in shambles. It's all over. But remember, we're dealing with Elmer Gantry. Somehow he finds an attorney who says, Elmer, leave it to me. And the attorney goes to him and says, what do you want? Elmer's asking the wrong questions. And they name their price, he writes them a check, and off they go to the next town. Elmer goes back to the church, and it's been the headlines, preacher denounced as fraud, as womanizer, and all the rest of it. He wonders how his congregation's going to accept him. He doesn't know. They're filled to the brim. People are outside in the vestibule. Some are kneeling on the sidewalk down the street with little loudspeakers out there. They don't know whether this is going to be his farewell speech. He doesn't know whether they're going to tar and feather him. He walks in, and this is what he says. They rose, cheered, and cheered. Theirs were the shining faces. Without planning it, Elmer knelt on the platform, holding his hands out to them, sobbing. And with him, they all knelt and sobbed and prayed while outside the locked glass door of the church, seeing the mob kneel with... Hundreds knelt on the steps of the church, on the sidewalk, all down the block. Oh, my friends, cried Elmer, do you believe in my innocence, in the fiendishness of my accusers? Reassure me with a hallelujah. The church thundered with a triumphant hallelujah. In a sacred silence, Elmer prayed. Oh, Lord, thou hast stooped from thy mighty throne and rescued thy servant from the assault of the mercenaries of Satan. Mostly we thank thee, because thus we can go on doing thy work and thine alone. Not less, but more zealously shall we seek utter purity and the prayer life and rejoice in freedom from all temptations. He turned to include the choir, and for the first time he saw that there was a new singer, a girl with charming ankles and lively eyes, with whom he would certainly have to become well acquainted. But the thought was so swift that it did not interrupt the paean of his prayer. Let me count this day, Lord, as the beginning of a new and more vigorous life, as the beginning of a crusade for complete morality and the domination of the Christian church through all the land. Dear Lord, thy work is but begun. We shall yet make these United Nations a moral nation. United States, a moral nation. And that's how the book ends. He's vindicated once again. He's gone through all these things. He's risen to be the bishop of the area, 2,500 people in the congregation, gone through 3 assorted affairs, and he comes out unscathed and people love him. Now, if that's your meat and potatoes that Sinclair Lewis made me for you, I think it's time to go eat dinner. Thanks for coming.